Welcome, especially to those coming for the first time tonight. Welcome to Warm Jewel Temple for an evening of Dharma exploration, which means exploration of ourself and our experience. We have a Dharma theme, a teaching theme for this year of 2017 here. Non-separation. What a great theme. What's not included in that theme? And for those of you who know me, when looking at a theme, I like to go right to like the root of it, kind of like push aside all the branches and leaves and try to get to the bottom of it. What is the sense of separation? What is non-separation truly? I mean, we can work on acting as if we're not separate from each other, for example, which is a great practice to do. But the reason I was drawn to Zen is because it goes to the root of these things. It's like, let's look clearly at what is this belief in separation and how can we be free from it. And going to the root takes care of the branches. And ironically, when you get right down to the very root of the matter, things get very, very simple. It's more like the branches and the leaves are diverse and complex, and there's a lot to work with in the branches and the leaves, but with the root, there's not much to work with. It's basically just understanding what it is. Early on in my Zen practice, I still have all these notes from first getting into Zen wholeheartedly 20-something years ago, and going through all of Dogen's writings. Dogen, our Zen founder, who has kind of cryptic-sounding writings, and like looking for the true instruction of how you practice Zazen. And I still go through, find these notes sometimes, and it's kind of funny because I'm looking for something tangible. Like when he says, line up your nose with your navel and your ears with your shoulders. I'd write that part down. Like, I can do that. And once I got the collection of all the real, like, practical methods that Dogen offered, there wasn't much there. It was some posture instructions. And, I was like, is it just that? I think it's because Dogen's always talking about the root, and it's hard to, the root is not really like, doesn't really come in such practical packaged instructions. Maybe we can try. Maybe that's what we do try in a Dharma talk. We try to convey something about this very simple but ineffable practice. So tonight I'll bring up this koan, this Zen story from the old days in the Book of Serenity, case 43, called Luo Shan's Arising and Vanishing. These collections of old stories usually start with an introduction to get us in the mood before the stories presented. So here's the introduction to this story. One drop of elixir, like ambrosia, the magical potion. One drop turns iron into gold. One word of the ultimate principle transforms an ordinary person into a sage. It just takes one drop, or one word. It's very simple when you get down to the root. If you know that gold and iron are not two, that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then, after all, you'll have no use for this drop, this word, right? We just need this one drop to do this little tweak, to turn iron into gold, to turn an ordinary person to a sage. If you know that gold and iron are not two, and that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then, after all, you'll have no use for this. But tell me, what one drop is it? Just in case you might have some use for it. That's the introduction. Are you in the mood now for a Zen story that points at the root? It's a short story. Luoshan asked Yan To, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yan To shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? The end. What a sweet story. I love Zen.
So who is arising and ceasing is it?
So whose? Oh. I like a question, yeah. When arising and ceasing go on unceasingly, what then? Yan To shouted and said, whose arising and ceasing is it? Yeah, who's the? It's a question.
Who is the arising and ceasing belong to?
Yes. So first we have this question. When arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? And so one could just hear this as a kind of abstract Zen-like question because they're just trying to say something good about reality. Or we can hear this as our question. Like, do you have this question? I mean, I have this question. Kind of like all day long, right? Because all day long, it seems like there's this arising and ceasing, rising and vanishing of stuff happening pretty much unceasingly. And it's kind of difficult, isn't it? Arising and vanishing go on unceasingly. Sometimes it's kind of okay, the things that arise and vanish, and sometimes it's painful. And sometimes it's not so busy, although arising and ceasing, by its very definition, is like a little bit busy, if not way busy, right? Arising and ceasing go on unceasingly. And, you know, these are meditators talking too, so it could be talking about, when I try to sit zazen, it seems like there's this unceasing arising and vanishing of stuff happening. What about that? What then is the question, right? Or I think what then is like, how do I deal with this? How do I live in this world of arising and ceasing, painful and sometimes pleasant experiences arising and ceasing? It's kind of like one of these root kind of questions, right? It's like, it's not so much, how do I work this particular issue of this one person that keeps arising in my experience and annoying me? Usually that's a little bit in the, like the branches kind of question, right? Those, you know, we can ask those too, and we can work out the particulars of how to relate to that person and practice kind speech with them and so on. But usually the Zen ancestors are like, we want one drop that will address all situations of arising and ceasing, like that annoying person. But as soon as we work it out with them, there's going to be another annoying person over here. or a really alluring person. So, or situation. It's kind of, it seems like it goes on unceasingly. Doesn't it? And it seems like it's not so easy to work with. To find a really settled freedom in the midst of arising and vanishing, happening unceasingly. So hopefully we can all hear this as our question. You can put it in your own words, how you might ask it. But isn't this our issue? All of us? And you might say, no, it's not. My issue is this particular thing. But isn't it about that this particular thing keeps arising? Or vanishing unceasingly, and then another thing does. You know, and we sometimes hear instructions like, well, just, you know, try to accept all this arising and ceasing and just patiently bear it. That's a good teaching too, but usually these Zen root teachings are looking for something more than just kind of like bearing it. Bearing it's actually, I think, a great start. Really like just accepting the arising and ceasing, going on and on and on. But sometimes we end it there. We said, that's enough to work with for this whole lifetime. It may be, but then there's no end to this having to keep accepting it and patiently accepting it. Maybe that's good enough, but this is like kind of like trying to have a whole different perspective on what's happening here. When arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? And Yanto shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? This related to this topic of just trying to patiently bear it. This maybe sounds a little bit different, but the commentary on the story begins. This practitioner Lu Shan, the one who asked the question, he first went to this other Zen teacher, Shi Shuang, and asked, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? This was his question. And Shi Shuang, the Zen teacher, said, you must be cold ashes, a dead tree, one thought for 10,000 years, box and lid joined, pure and spotlessly clear. That was his instructions. And Luo Shan didn't get it. Also, to me, that sounds like very difficult, doesn't it? When arising and ceasing are like going on unceasingly, what do you do? The teacher says, just be like a dead tree. Okay, I'll try. That's what we try sometimes, right? Let's just sit really still and just let go of all this thinking for one moment, and then it arises again, doesn't it? Unceasingly. And then it ceases, and then it arises, and then something ceases and arises. So, okay, just dead tree, come on, we can do it. Dead tree, but the leaves keep sprouting out of the dead tree, right? Cut them off, just cut them, cut them, cut them. There's no end to this. This is a lively tree. tree. It's going to make this tree really dead. You can't just keep like pulling the leaves off, right? We have to go for the root. But when we hear those instructions, it sounds like, just try to be a dead tree. Try to be like cold ashes in a like, sometimes they say like an incensor in an abandoned temple that's, you know, just collecting dust. So, that was the first instruction he got, Luo Shan. And he didn't get it. So he went and asked another teacher, Yan To, who shouted and said, "Whose arising and vanishing is it?" At this, Luo Shan awakened. So he got it this time. Generally, the commentary says, Yan To just esteemed clarity of insight, whereas Shi Shuang, the first teacher who talked about the dead tree, set up a dead tree hall. He demanded that one personally arrive once first. And you might have heard about Shi Shuang's dead tree hall. It was the name for his zendo. Yeah. Yeah, so everybody just go in the room and sit like dead trees, and we're not going to have any walking or moving for the next 10,000 years. But what about all this arising? Dead tree. So that's one approach. He was a great ancestor, Shi Shuang, and with his dead tree hall. Lifeless room full of cobwebs and dust. So that's one way. And it says he demanded that one personally arrive once first. And I think this means like he wanted people to really taste the coolness of freedom from arising and ceasing in this really like, you know, strong way, like nothing bothering a dead tree. Arrive here once. Whereas Yan To's method was not about like you have to get to this place where nothing's happening. His method is about the commentary says esteeming clarity of insight. So it's not so much about just stopping, letting go, dropping, cutting off all the branches. It's more like just seeing clearly the situation directly in a very simple way. It's one drop, one word. When arising and ceasing go on unceasingly, what then? Well, whose arising and ceasing is it? Just really this one word, whose, is the turning word. So whose arising and ceasing is it, right? In our own experience, this is a great question. I like the Zen instructions that are simple and that you can do on the cushion or off the cushion. This is simple enough that it's a nice saying you could carry all day long through a day of arising and ceasing experiences, especially when they're difficult or we're feeling overwhelmed by the busyness of arising and ceasing, to ask whose arising and ceasing is it? And we might say, mine. It's my arising and ceasing. It's my experience. And then who is this me? And I think often we our sort of instinctual, habitual version of me is this body and mind of which is also arising and ceasing unceasingly. We feel like that's what it's this body and mind is arising and vanishing unceasingly, and everything that's happening to it is arising and vanishing unceasingly. And this is, it's impermanence. The Buddha taught impermanence, right? So, but it's wearisome, all this coming and going. So the first look, we might say, this body and mind, that's who's arising and ceasing. All this stuff is happening to, or all this arising and ceasing stuff is happening to this body and mind. And therefore, it's this body and mind is very fragile and subject to suffering. As the Buddha said, all impermanent things are dissatisfying ultimately. So we can look deeper. We could say, if the body and mind is arising and vanishing unceasingly, who's unceasingly arising and vanishing body and mind is this, right? That's part of the arising and ceasing too. Whose body and mind is it? We can keep asking this question till we can't go back any further. Isn't there an experiencing of our body and mind at this moment? There's just present experiencing. And we could say this experiencing is what the body and mind is happening to or in. Can you have a sense of that? It's like body and mind. Well, how do we know that there's a body and mind? Well, there's an experiencing of it, right? So that's like a little bit, it's a step back from the body and mind. A subtle step back. We usually don't go beyond body. We just, I am this body and mind, period. There's nothing behind that. But actually, the only way we know that there's a body and a mind arising and ceasing is there is the experiencing of it, isn't there? So I think we could say this experiencing, not the experiencer, right? That's some other thing. And not the experience, that's just coming and going, but the experiencing is who all of this is happening to. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. We can call it different names. I like the name. It's nice to change around the name some. But we can also call experiencing other names for it. And these are experiential names. So check out in your own experience if these names don't ring true for you. Please call me on it and say, like, that doesn't sound like experiencing. So some of the other names I would propose we could call experiencing are presence. Presence. Now is another name for experiencing. Now, not like some abstract now, but this now that's happening to us is called experiencing. Yeah. We can call it awareness. Experiencing. We can call it knowing. Not knowing something necessarily, but just the knowing of a body and a mind and a world of that are arising and ceasing. And then those are kind of ordinary names for this, right, that we all share, right? I can't read your minds exactly, but I can do this one mind reading trick. Check this out. I personally can guarantee that all of you listening to me are experiencing right now. Cool, huh? Impressed, aren't you? I say, how did you know that? If you didn't hear that, then you weren't, maybe. Then it's, I'm not talking to you. But you who hear it, right, are the experiencing. You are the awareness. You are presence. And then the, you know, Buddhist tradition has fancier names for it, so which can get distracting. So that's to just say experiencing. But it can also be called Buddha nature, Tathagata Garbha, Prajna Paramita. I propose, you can argue with me if you, now or later if you want. That sounds nothing like experiencing, but I propose these are synonyms. Slightly different, you know, facets of this one jewel called totally ordinary experiencing that all the arising and ceasing is happening to. And if we start, this one word, whose is it? If we take that question seriously, right, the teacher wasn't saying it as a kind of rhetorical thing. It was more like a practice instruction, right, to the one asking, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? This is not just some Zen game, right? This is like, if you really want to know how to deal with this completely and be really totally free in the midst of this, take this question to heart. Who is arising and vanishing is it? And it sounds like that's what Yanto or Luo Shan did. He asked himself, who's arising, vanishing, is it? Like if you were to ask this to yourself right now, where do you go to answer the question? Or where does your mind go to answer the question, who's arising and vanishing, is it? What would you say? Yeah. Like in your own experience, yes? We could say it like that. In a way, it's a little bit more theoretical, I would say, to say it, because it's more like it must be that our experiences are joining together. But in our most direct experiencing, without any theorizing, where do you go to answer? Who's arising and vanishing, is it? In a way, if we look to like, well, it's the one that we all share together is a little bit going out into some kind of arising and ceasing, another piece of arising and ceasing multiplicity of people. So we're kind of like, without going to anything that's arising and ceasing to answer the question, because that wouldn't really be answering the question, right? Who's arising and ceasing, is it? If we say it's like this body is, well, the body is arising and ceasing. This conceptual mind and thinking mind, that's arising and ceasing. So the arising and ceasing can't belong to it, right?
I wasn't suggesting in the sense of belonging, but in the sense of experiencing. Or to put it another way, it's in Zazen, the arising and ceasing that is power.
So the arising and ceasing that is ours is like Zazen? I think that's true. That's another name we can add to the list of Tathagata Garbha and Prajnaparamita. Zazen. Yeah, I think that's a nice definition of Zazen, actually, is the experiencing of what's happening. Yeah, that's like pure Zazen. Just being the experiencing of what's happening. So in order to answer this question, where do you go? Any other experiential answers anyone like to offer? Like your mind, my mind and your mind they're constantly engaging in the arising and ceasing experiences, right? I could say, whose are these? arising and ceasing experiences, it, to really take the question seriously, right? Well, whose are they actually? Where do you start looking? Where, that's what I mean by where do you go? Where do you look to answer the question? Yes. Yeah. Doesn't that seem so? Return the light that's engaged in all the arising and ceasing stuff. It's kind of called outward directed light of awareness. We turn it around, we look back at the source of where is all, what's all this happening to. We look back. Yeah, so this Dogen calls it the backward step. And what do we find when we look back? Do we find some little person like, hi, you've been looking for me, haven't you? No. We don't see that one. That'd be nice, right? I got you. We don't see anything, right? We don't. If we saw something, it would just be more arising and ceasing, and then we'd have to ask the same question. That little guy waving, he's arising and ceasing, right? Who's arising and ceasing is that the waving guy, right? If they keep going back, and anything that we find that seems to be arising and ceasing, that's not it, right? That's, we can ask, whose is that? So we keep looking back until we don't find anything that's arising and ceasing. And we can call that, that sounds very kind of mystical and mysterious, right? So sometimes we call it prajnaparamita, or vast emptiness, but that's kind of a little highfalutin. We could just call it experiencing. Experiencing is like totally ungraspable, isn't it? What is experiencing? It's not the body and mind. That's body and mind are experiences happening to experiencing. But the experiencing, actually, if we look at it in a certain way, it seems, in a certain way being like just a clear look, I would propose that the experiencing is actually not arising and vanishing. The experiences are, so it, we might say experiencing is constantly changing, but the experiencing I'm speaking of is the one that's always exactly the same. It's always just experiencing. Can you follow that? Experientially? Yes?
Well, I'm trying to bring that argument back. It seems like it's the senses are experiencing.
Yeah, and we can include the five physical senses and the mind sense also. So yeah, we could say, and sometimes in Zen they speak this way, is this one light, we could call it Linji, the Zen teacher Linji says, all of us are this one single brightness. It's kind of poetic name, I'd say, for called, of experiencing. We're all this one single experiencing, but in the eyes, we call it seeing. That's a kind of experiencing. In the ears, we call it hearing. In the nose, smelling. In the mouth, tasting. And speaking, Linji says. Speaking is a kind of experiencing. In the hands, we call it grabbing. In the feet, we call it walking. In the mind, we call it thinking and feeling. These are all forms of experiencing. But the experiences of, say, like color and sound and sensation and thought, those are more like the experiences. They're like the nouns, right? And those are constantly arising and ceasing, but the experiencing of them, even though you could say it has different shades of color, right? The experiencing sometimes comes in the form of seeing, sometimes comes in the form of hearing. So we might say, that sounds like those things are changing. But if we call them all this one experiencing, we could say that's the totality of experiencing is the one reality that's not arising and ceasing. It's not coming and going. Yeah. Or we could call it the awareness of whatever's happening is actually not coming and going. You know, the thinking of a particular thing, like I'm thinking about this book, now I'm thinking about the floor, like those thoughts are coming and going, but that's not awareness. The awareness is just totally ungraspable, ineffable, meaning we can't really say what it is. And yet, this is it, right? I would also propose that it's the one, if we're talking about, if we're looking for like reality would have to be something that's like, doesn't come and go, right? That's sort of how I think of reality, as something that's always the case and also 100% verifiable. Any reality that I want to, you know, take refuge in must be like not some speculative, hidden something that someday I will like come to realize. The reality, the ever-present reality must be something that's ever available. So could we say that experiencing is 100% verifiable? It's the one reality that's 100% verifiable. Like, I like to think of it as like, you know, we're probably like awake right now, but there's a chance we could be dreaming, right? Because when we're actually dreaming asleep, it seems totally real, and then we wake up and we're like, wow, I really thought that was real, but now that I woke up, I see it was a dream. So I'm open to the possibility that I'm actually dreaming right now, and you're all in my dream. Like, if somebody said, can you prove definitively 100% that you're not dreaming right now? I would say, no, I don't think I can. I could probably prove it like 98%, and I look for some evidence, but not 100%, right? But the fact of experiencing or awareness, that can be verified 100% every moment, I would propose. Isn't that kind of cool? Like, that's something that, like, therefore it can fit this definition of, like, a verifiable reality. And part of the experiencing is, the experiencing itself is all-inclusive. It's the experiencing isn't like picking and choosing different parts according to its wishes. You might say, I'm doing that, right? My habitual consciousness is picking and choosing. But the experiencing isn't in control of that, really, right? It's just experiencing, pure witness, right? Mm. Yes?
Oh, when you said, where do you go?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. That sense of non-separation, right? Non-separation that I speak of is non-separation between me, whatever I think of as me, like a body and mind, and the rest of the world and other people in it. So I think sometimes we just land on that, especially if we're in the wilderness and we're not carrying much. but sometimes I think it helps. It can help, and you can check this out. It might not work for you so much, but I think that often what we do is we identify with this body and conceptual mind as me. And the Buddha taught that we grasp. He talks about grasping the five aggregates, which is a fancy way of saying the body and mind as me. And so we identify with, and identify means be one with, right? The word identify means become one with, actually, right? So we've actually become me. I identify with the body and mind as me. In other words, me is just this body and mind. It's identified with this body and mind, but nothing other than this body and mind. That's, I think, a usual way I propose. I feel like that experience is going through the world. I'm identified with this body and mind as me, but not your body and mind. I don't say you are me. That's called separation. I don't say the world is me. I'm identified with part of experiencing. There's experiencing of a body and mind in a world, right? But I'm identifying with this one particular part. And there's reasons we identify with this particular part called the body and mind. There's evolutionary reasons and so on. But from a Buddhist point of view, it's actually inaccurate. It's a delusion, and it's a deep one. So sometimes first, you can take this step of kind of like disidentifying with the body and mind in a way, and that's, I think, what this question can be pointing to. When all this stuff is arising and ceasing, and this body and mind experience, what can be done? Who is arising and ceasing? Is that we take this step back to experiencing, which is not the body and mind. The experiencing is experiencing a body and mind. The body and mind are objects of the experiencing awareness. So we, in a way, disidentify with the body and mind and identify with the experiencing, right? Which is much bigger than the body and mind. So we in a way, we shift our identity. Now, I am not like a body and mind changing. I am the experiencing of everything in my experiencing world, my experienced world. I'm the experiencing aspect of it. You might say that's just a little shift, isn't it? But I think it's this one drop of elixir that turns iron into gold. It's one word of the ultimate principle that transforms an ordinary person into a sage. Really, just to shift the identity by, and not to do it as a kind of like telling ourselves to just try it on as a sort of mind trick, right? But actually by investigating our own experience very, very carefully. And this is what we often don't do because we're too busy in the arising and ceasing flow of stuff to check out whose it is. Does that make sense? We shift our identity to the experiencing, ungraspable awareness. So that's one step, but this is still separation, I propose. Now I'm identified with the experiencing awareness, but I'm still witnessing a world of others, other people in the world. Do you see how that's still separated? I've just become much bigger. Right? I'm not limiting that to this body and mind. I am like the all-inclusive experiencing, but everything still seems like objects of me, right? I'm the witness of the world, including the body, which was previously identified as the subject, has now become an object called experience of sensations, is now an object of the experiencing, witnessing awareness, but still maybe some separation. So then we can re-identify. Now we can, and through actually examination, we can re-identify with the body again. And the mind, the conceptual thoughts, and the world, because when we actually look for those things from the point of view of the experiencing, this is the question I like to ask in Zazen, ask myself these days, you could call it a little bit of a method maybe. When getting to this point, the question to find the non-separation, it's a kind of a two-step process, right? First is like, Whose arising and vanishing is it? Okay, it's the experiencings. It's the awarenesses. Then, now I am the awareness, and we have to ask this question now as the awareness. Just once we kind of get the hang of it, it's not that difficult. Just have to have a very flexible, experimental mind to try this. I really actually am the awareness. And now as the awareness, I can now ask, and this is the question I'm leading up to, the question is, how far away from me is, like, the experience of that bird sound? Usually, as a body and mind, I think that bird sound is 30 feet from me, the body and mind. But as the experiencing, that includes, as Yaro said, all the senses, includes hearing, is part of the experiencing. How far away from me, the experiencing, is the experience called the bird sound? When you check it out, how far away from you? You are the experiencing. How far away from you is that sound? Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's not. And if you taste that right now, which I think when you just answered it that you really did, that's called non-separation, right? There's really, if you kind of get the grok, the kind of import, the implications of this, right? This is truly actually called experiencing total non-separation, non-duality, right? For that moment. And you could say that's actually reality. It's verifiable reality, right? But it's a shift of perspective because we have to first discern that who I really am, and it seems to be the case, is the experiencing. And then we can go further just to get more used to it and say, like, you bring in some other senses, like, we look at the book here, right? And we say, so like, which is closer, right? The sound of the bird, the experienced sound of the bird, or the experienced visual book, which is closer to me, to you? Yeah, they're the same distance. And then I think, same difference, which is no difference. And then I think a particularly juicy one is the fifth sense called body or tactile sensation. Like if you have a tension in the stomach, which is closer, the sound of the car on the highway, that the experience of the car on the highway, or the experience of the tension in the stomach. Mm-hmm. They're both objects called experiences to the experiencing. And we see that they're also equidistant, right? Yeah. Which is no distant.
Depends on which one you notice first.
Yeah, and you can go from one to the other, and they're equally non-separate from the experiencing. And I think I say the body is this particularly juicy one because we hold this sense of separation, as we're speaking of it here, is a kind of cognitive thing, right? It's a misperception. It's called dualistic perception that we're kind of evolved to, you know, live in this delusion. And we can, if you follow this exercise here, you can see how it really is not that big a thing to undo it for a moment, right? I'd say that really is experiencing non-duality. Mm-hmm. To live that way all the time is a long training process, right? Because we're so accustomed to this other way. But it's a cognitive misunderstanding, a mental misunderstanding. But then based on this mental misunderstanding, which began like eons ago, you could say, we hold it in the body. We hold the sense of separation very strongly in the body. And I would say the bodily sense of, like, if somebody says, "You idiot," our body contracts and our body feels separate. And even just looking at another body, we feel like they're not me, especially if they're saying something I don't like. We really feel the body, the feeling sense in the body, I think, is where we hold most of the actual experiential sense of this deluded separation. It's based on a cognitive thought, actually. But it's, the body has been tricked by this thought for so long that it, the body is actually deluded in a way now too, right? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's like the thoughts just, the belief in a separate self and, is like this tip of the iceberg, and underneath the iceberg is this bodily feeling that I am separate, which is why I think when we hear these teachings about no self, which those who hang around these Zen centers for a while, you hear this a lot, and feel like, yeah, I get that. It seems really true. I can actually understand it conceptually, but it doesn't really affect my daily life so much. It seems like a kind of a theoretical thing. I would say because we're giving more credence to the bodily feeling of separation that's actually based on this thought.
We're so conditioned,
yeah. So I think, and in practice we can use both. We can use, in a way, the tradition usually goes, the Zen tradition especially, goes to this root of like, let's, if we unravel the misperception, then the bodily feeling takes longer to catch up. That's why we can, I really get this no self thing, but I don't feel like it. Because it takes longer for the body to catch up. And we can work, so the Zen teachings often go to the root, the mind root, but then the practices engage the body also, like sitting zazen, in a particular posture, and relaxing the body and the breath. We get that in beginning zazen instruction. Working with these physical elements, even though they're just kind of experiences, they're not really who we are. They also, they work together with the experiencing awareness. And kind of traditional Zen maybe goes more at like this commentary said, Yanto just esteemed clarity of insight, whereas this other teacher, Shishuang, set up this dead tree hall, which means like, just sit still in your body and don't move. And the kind of more sudden approach is you just shift the perspective, and then the body will catch up. But this other approach is more like just sit for a really long time, and then maybe this perspective will shift in your mind too. But that's, I would say that's maybe less reliable. I feel like it's it might take a long, long time. And I think this one drop is why we call it the sudden school Zen. But it's, we have to be really attentive. So, Yes?
It's kind of a reverse of what you were saying about first the thought and then the mind, I mean the body.
Mm-hmm.
Sound of the bird or the dog sets up or activates a vibratory response, which can take you out of mind into a much larger space. Mm. That's what I experience.
Mm.
So it's like the body has a resonance with that, with everything.
Yeah.
Already.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because direct experiencing is actually non-duality, non-separation too, right? So just sound, just color, just physical sensation, if we really get into the justness of them, we reach the same experiencing. Where we almost can't even say now what sound is anymore, and what color is, and what feeling is. They're good in, they're also good in that they're so, they're non-discursive. So, yeah, they're not thinking these sensations. And, in a way, these koans come in words, right? But a question like, who's arising and vanishing, is it? I think ideally that kind of question immediately cuts off thought. If we start thinking about, well, whose is it? Could it be Kokyo's or somebody else's? If we start thinking at all, in a way, we're going back into the arising and ceasing. But these Zen questions of like, whose is it, are meant to actually go right to the direct, non-thinking experiencing. And then we could say this experiencing is Zazen, as we said, right? Or self-enjoyment samadhi is experiencing, and it's always the case. And then sometimes we do this coming and going thing of putting a body on a cushion and sitting, and then sometimes we discover the self-enjoyment samadhi that's always happening, right? But we sometimes discover it, or we align the arising and ceasing body and mind with it. So this, I think this disidentifying with our limited body and mind temporarily, and then re-identifying with not just the body and mind, but everything, right? So that's the difference. First we're identifying with the limited part of experience, then we temporarily disidentify because to understand the primacy, we could say, of the experiencing awareness. And then from there we then see if nothing is any distance from me, the experiencing, then we re-identify with everything is the experiencing. Everything that we called experiences now are actually seen as just the experiencing itself. So we re-identify with like the larger body and mind that's basically the entire universe. So it's not so much, first there is a mountain, right? We think there's a mountain out there. Then we disidentify with the mountain. We say, actually, there is no mountain. There's just the experiencing. And then we see, but how far away is this experience of the mountain from me? No distance. So now there is a mountain again, but the mountain is now just experiencing in the form of a mountain. So that's a story for tonight, and a practice that we can explore on the cushion and off the cushion, when overwhelmed or underwhelmed by arising and ceasing experiences. Whose arising and ceasing is it? Gather all our aspirations to be presence and dedicate them to all beings everywhere dissatisfied with the arising and ceasing experiences of the moment. May they realize this dissatisfaction is nothing but experiencing. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.